Have you ever tried to bargain with God? Some of the classic deals are from the student. God, if you just please help me pass this test, I'll do something for you, something good. I'm not sure what it is, but something good. Or they have the foxhole prayer. We have the soldier in the foxhole and maybe some serious conflict going on all around, bombs going off. And the soldier just asks God, God, if you get me out of this. Now, what that soldier offers probably depends on where he comes into that foxhole with God. So if he's already a believer, maybe some expanded service to God, he's going to take God more seriously. If he's not a believer, I'm going to believe in you, God. But sometimes as humans, we like to try to make deals with God. Now, I think in a church like ours, we understand that's probably not the appropriate way to approach God. And so maybe we wouldn't do it so overtly. But sometimes the same mindset that leads somebody to try to bargain with God, even though it might not make us try to bargain with God, it affects the way we look at God and the way we look at other people and the way that we look at ourselves. So I want to try to understand that mindset, the mindset that wants to bargain with God, and to see if that maybe pops up in our lives in other ways. All right, so we're going to look at somebody who tried to bargain with God. It's Jacob. We're going to turn to Genesis 28. So this is a story basically called Jacob's Ladder. I was actually talking to my dad last night, and he asked me what I was preaching on, and I told him Jacob's Ladder. He said, I don't think I've ever heard a sermon about that before. Now, Jacob's Ladder as a story pops up a lot in Sunday school. We should like to teach it to our kids. I'm not sure what the moral of the story is, except this is something cool that happened. But Jacob, you'll see that Jacob has this vision with angels and God, and that's one reason why it comes up so much in Sunday school. And I'm not under the illusion that I'm the only one who's ever preached on this story, because I'm sure I'm not. We don't normally come here. But let's look at this guy, Jacob, and not so much what happens in the vision, but let's look at what happens after the vision. So we're going to start reading in verse 10. So Jacob left Beersheba and set out for Haran. When he reached a certain place, he stopped for the night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones there, he put it under his head and lay down to sleep. All right, so let's stop there for a minute. See, Jacob's on a journey. This is not a business trip. This is not for vacation. Jacob's running for his life, literally. Now, who's he running from? His brother. Why is he running from his brother for? Well, they got some issues in their family. All right, now, I try to make the story as short as possible, but I'm very fascinated by the dynamics that we see unfolding these stories in Genesis. And sometimes they just throw out these stories, and they don't go into a lot of detail. You just see what happens. So at least for a lot of speculation. But basically what happened is Jacob is Abraham's grandson. All right, we looked at Abraham last week. And Abraham's son was Isaac, and Isaac had two boys, twins, Jacob and Esau. Now, Esau is the older, but not by much. Now, in their culture, the oldest son is the one who gets the bigger inheritance, who gets the bigger blessing. And besides that, Isaac and his wife Rebekah have favorites. Isaac prefers Esau. He's kind of a warrior, hunter kind of guy, outdoorsman, manly man, dare I say. Jacob is a little bit different than that. I'm not saying he's a girly man, because he's not really that. But he's a herdsman. He's a farmer. He's a good cook, actually. All right, and Rebekah prefers Jacob. And so the time has come. Isaac's older, and he's ready. He thinks he's about ready to die. His eyesight's failing. And he calls Esau to him and said, son, go out and catch some wild game. Make some stew. You know how I like it. Bring it back to me, and I'll give you the blessing. Because this was a very solemn and formal event that happened in the life of a family, where the blessing was sent off to whoever was going to be blessed. And they thought of this experience as binding. These words meant something. It wasn't just, you know, some kind, it's not like a Hallmark greeting card. This was powerful in the life of the family. So Esau goes out, and Rebekah sees this, and she comes up with this great plan. She goes to Jacob and says, why don't you steal Esau's blessing? She didn't exactly say it like that. But she's like, we'll trick Isaac. He can't see so well anymore. So you go, we'll have you cook up a goat. So goat's kind of gamey. I've never had goat, but I guess it's kind of gamey. Maybe it kind of approximate a wild animal. You bring that to him, have him eat it, and then he'll bless you instead. Now Jacob, being the upstanding moral person that he is, objects to the plan, because he's like, what if I get caught, is basically what he says. All right, so he's not really worried about tricking Isaac, it seems. He's just worried that he's going to get caught in the end, which is actually a pretty good suspicion on his part. Because Esau is very hairy. He's a very hairy guy. Jacob was smooth-skinned. So Rebekah says, okay, we'll put a goat skin on you. That's how hairy Esau was, that you could put a goat skin on Jacob, and that's basically what Esau felt like. So with goat skin wrapped around him, with his stew, Jacob goes to Isaac, and it works. They trick him. There's a, you know, a kind of a dicey moment where Isaac's like, well, you kind of sound like Jacob, but you feel like Esau, and you kind of smell like him too, because they had done some other work that way. All right, I'll give you the blessing. So he passes this blessing on to Jacob. Then, wouldn't you know it, Esau comes back later. Now, I'm not sure what Jacob and Rebekah's plan was for this. I mean, because they had to know that Esau was going to come back eventually. And so he comes back with his stew, and Isaac is all surprised and shocked, and he's trembling. He's like, who did I just bless? Esau figures out right away. He's like, oh, that rat Jacob. I knew he'd pull something like this. Esau pleads for the blessing. But Isaac says, because this is how they thought, I've given him the blessing. Everything I said is going to come true. And so Esau just kind of weeps bitterly about this. But then he has this comforting thought. When Isaac dies, I'm going to kill Jacob. So you can imagine Esau kind of walking around, kind of upset and sad. Then all of a sudden a smile goes over his face and his mind's like, I'm going to kill that boy. All right. Rebekah knows this. She sends away Jacob because she doesn't want him to get killed. And so she comes to Isaac. Again, nobody actually is honest in this family. But she comes to him and says, you know, I don't want him to marry these local Canaanite women. Send him off back to my family. They lived a long ways away. But send him off to my family where he can find a wife, and then it'll be good because he won't marry one of these local women. You know I hate these local women. All right, so Isaac sends Jacob off, and that's where Jacob is. All right, this is a 550-mile journey. All right, so if you can see this a little bit, they're in Beersheba, which is all the way down here. They have to go all the way up here. This is kind of, you know, the Middle East here, up through where Israel is, and all the way up to, like, you know, we're Syria, into Haran. All right, 550 miles by foot. No horse, no camel. So I'm not sure how many miles he's walking a day, but I imagine this is going to at least take a month or so, right? Probably longer than that. He's also very vulnerable here. You see that he lays down, even though you'll see there's this city that's nearby, but he doesn't go into the city. Why? Very possible that he's afraid for his life. He's afraid if he goes into the city, they might kill him. Because, you know, there's no hotels really back then. If you're a stranger and you come into the wrong place, they might kill you. You know, there's no guarantees here. This is a dangerous journey that Jacob is undergoing, okay? And so this is his state. It's not really a good state, is it? He's very vulnerable right now. Is there anybody else traveling with him? He's really nothing else going for him. Will he ever make it back to Isaac or to the rest of his family? Will he ever make it back? Doesn't know. All right. But he has this dream there. All right, so sorry, the top's cut off a little bit. But we'll start in verse 12. He had a dream in which he saw a stairway resting on the earth with its top reaching to heaven, and the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. There above it stood the Lord, and he said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. I'll give you your descendants, you and your descendants, the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. So let's talk a little bit about the vision that he sees. You know, sometimes we call it Jacob's ladder, so we imagine the ladder going up and the angels coming up and down. Probably more likely it's something like this. All right, that's the actual painting of the vision. So you see that it's not really, it's more likely to be like steps, okay, like a stairway more than a ladder. All right, so you got the angels coming down, you got God all the way up on top. In the painting, they didn't show God, obviously, because, you know, that's kind of sacrilegious to actually show God a little bit. So we can show the angels, but we can't show God. So he's up there somewhere at the top. So this is what Jacob sees. All right, now, in Jacob's mind, when he saw this vision, and he saw this stairway, it would have reminded him of something that he had probably seen in his time, a ziggurat. All right, that's a ziggurat. This is the ziggurat of Ur. So you see this stairway? This is how they built a lot of temples back in the ancient days, all right? So you had these stairways that went up, and the idea was you build it, and it was almost like it was basically building a stairway to heaven, like the Led Zeppelin song, I guess. Not really exactly like that, but a little bit like that. And the idea was at the top is where God meets you. And so you're basically building a way for God to come down to your lands. Now, if you look at the very top, see those people up there? You probably can't see it. Those are actually U.S. soldiers, because this is the deserts of Iraq. It's not a tourist trap. All right. So the only people who really go there, if you look on Google, actually Google the Ziggurat of Ur, the only people you'll see in these pictures are American soldiers, because not many other people are making it out to the, out there. All right. So this is probably in his mind what Jacob sees. Now, this was actually built somewhere around the 21st century B.C., I believe. So this is probably a little bit after Jacob's time. But this was sort of the normal temple building idea. Now, when you build a temple, partly you do it to adore a deity or to worship a deity, but also you do it to manipulate a deity, okay? Because if you build this temple, it's almost like forcing that god to be in your land. You know, it's like creating a conduit, if you will, for that god to bless you. Because, you know, pagan religion, actually religion just in general, is always like part worship and part manipulation, all right? Because if we can do these things to appease the deity, then he will bless us. That is underlying a lot of religion, even within Christianity, not just the pagan religions. Any religion you look at, there's that little element of manipulation, that if we just do these things, God will do what we want him to do. All right, so it's kind of trying to force God's hand. All right, now if you listen to what God promises Jacob in this dream, these promises should seem familiar. What does he promise him? So you look back in those verses. You see, I'm going to give you this land where you're lying. Okay, so that's one blessing. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth. So you're going to become like this mighty nation, a whole bunch of descendants. And you're spread out to the west and to the east. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I'm with you wherever you go, and I'll bring you back here. But if you look at some of those core blessings that God promises, they should seem familiar to you, because that's what God promised Abraham. All right, so basically what's happening here is God is taking this covenant he made with Abraham, because that's what he did with Abraham. You can look about this in Genesis 12. If you're here last week, we talked about it a little bit. But God promised Abraham, I'm going to give you descendants. I'm going to make you into a nation. I'm going to make your name famous. So no one's going to forget you. People are going to remember your name. And you're going to get all this land. Just leave your father's house. Go to the land I'm showing you. I'll do all of these things. All right? So now what's happened is God traced that covenant, those blessings, through Isaac, and now it's gone down through Jacob. All right, so Jacob is going to receive, be on the receiving end of those blessings. Now, if you go back here to the promises God makes, I want you to look for the word if. Okay, so Psalm 13, I am the Lord. I will give you your descendants the land. Your descendants will be the west of the east. I'm just kind of skimming through this. I am with you. I will watch over you. I will not go, and I will bring you back to what I've done. If you look, there's not one if there. This is a straight-up promise. Doesn't even ask Jacob to do anything. Doesn't ask him to follow some law or to build some kind of altar. He just tells Jacob, I'm going to do this. So this is God just stepping in to Jacob's life in a very vulnerable state when Jacob really has nothing to going for him, nothing to offer God, and God says, I'm going to do all these things for you. All these insecurities you might have, all these fears you might have of whether you're ever going to make it back to your family's land, I'm going to bring you back safely. This is straight up grace. There's no other way to look at it. Jacob has done nothing to earn this. In fact, you could go the other way with it and say that Jacob has done everything not to earn this. He's been a manipulative, conniving, scheming kind of person. Nothing great about him. He tricked his dying father, for goodness sakes. Like, what kind of guy does that? And yet God pops into his life and just gives him grace. So this either is really frustrating to you, or it's really miraculous. I'm not sure which camp you fall into. It can be really frustrating because you're like, well, he doesn't deserve it. Of course, you could say, well, you know, God either had to give these blessings to either Jacob or Esau, and, you know, which one do you want to pick? You know, they're not really, neither one of them is so great here. But in the end, God chooses Jacob, and Jacob is the surprising choice because he's the younger one. But this is just straight up grace. This is God just coming into somebody's life and say, I'm going to bless you. Not even putting any conditions down. I'm going to do all these things because I am God. All right? So let's see how Jacob responds to this vision. All right. Yeah, I read that. All right, so he gets up in the morning, and he takes his stone because, stones are very versatile in the old days. They serve as pillows, and the next day they become memorial altars. And so he turns it around, and he offers, and he says, when Jacob awoke from his sleep, he thought, surely the Lord was in this place, and I was not aware of it. He was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. Now, he's kind of missing the point here a little bit, isn't he? Because it's not the place that really matters. But see, you know, Jacob in his probably ziggurat temple way of thinking in the ancient days thinks of God being confined to a location. It's not the place that's awesome. It's God that's awesome. The place is only awesome because God touches it. Okay? So the place was nothing special going into it. Even going away from it, it maybe has some significance now. But awesome is wherever God is. It's not dependent on the place. So he's not quite getting it yet. But maybe we give him a pass for that. That's a pretty, you know, substantial thing that happened to him. We'll give him a little bit of a pass there. Early the next morning, Jacob took the stone he had placed under his head and set up as a pillar and poured oil on top of it. He called the place Bethel, though the city used to be called Luz. All right, he's actually already acting as the owner of the land, because if you're the owner of the land, that's how you get to name it. He's just some passer through, and yet he names it. So he's sort of, maybe this is him believing a little bit in God's promise, that he names it Bethel, which means house of God, by the way. So you see Bethel quite a bit. There's like a Bethel home near me, but that literally means house of God. All right, so he renames it. Then he made a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will watch over me on this journey I'm taking and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear so that I return safely to my father's house, then the Lord will be my God, and this stone that I have set up as a pillar will be God's house, and all of you, and all of all that you give me, I will give you a tenth. So remember we looked for ifs in God's promise to Jacob? Let's look for ifs in Jacob's. If God will be with me. So all these really are ifs. If he gives me clothes to wear, food to eat, so I can return safely. He's putting in a lot of ifs here. He's putting a lot of conditions in his response to God. God put in no conditions. Jacob's putting in a whole litany of conditions. All right, so you could say at the very least, it doesn't quite seem like Jacob believes God. Because when you believe God, if you took God at his word, there's no if. See, with Abraham, there rarely was an if. Now, Abraham had his issues. He had some missteps. I'm not saying he was perfect. But for the most part, when God asks Abraham to do something, Abraham goes. There's no conversation about it. Go to the land I'll show you. Leave your father's house. Okay, I'll go. I'm going to give you, even though you're really, really old, and so is your wife, I'm going to give you a descendant. Okay, I believe you. Go and sacrifice your son Isaac. Okay, I'll do it. I'm not saying that he was, you know, that he didn't have any internal wonderings about this, but Abraham's a man of faith. He responds with faith. Jacob responds with conditions. And it's interesting at the end, because he says, then the Lord will be my God. Look at that. Then the Lord will be my God. Isn't he your God already? I mean, Jacob grew up in Isaac's house, Abraham's house, and Isaac was a worshiper of God as well. Why isn't God already Jacob's God? Well, it could be a few things. Either maybe Jacob didn't take religion very seriously. A lot of people are like that. They focus on what's there in front of them, the material. They don't get too caught up with this invisible spiritual stuff. Maybe Jacob's one of those guys. He's just too practical for it all. And he never really believed. Now, it's also possible in their day, God's a little bit more of a local phenomenon. This whole idea of building temples, God's sort of confined to that space. And so to put this in modern context, if you're going up Route 9 and you're going from Irvington to Ossining, well, you have to pay homage to the gods of Irvington. Then you get into Tarrytown, you got to pay homage to the gods of Tarrytown. Even if you didn't previously worship them, you got to pay homage to them. You get to Sleepy Hollow, pay homage to the Sleepy Hollow gods. And finally get to Ossining's gods, you got to worship them too. That's kind of how they thought. So when you're traveling, you got to pay attention to the different deities. All right, you can see this kind of thinking throughout Scripture. Maybe Jacob thinks that way too. So at any rate, in his mind, it's unsettled if God's going to be his God. He's got kind of a wait-and-see approach, doesn't he? All right, we'll see how this turns out, God. But if you do all that you say you're going to, we'll be fine. All right, you'll be my God, and I'll give you a tenth of everything I have. Come on, God, this is a great deal. You should take it. It's kind of silly, right? I'll give you a tenth of everything I have. Like, this is some big deal. Basically, he just said, the tenth of everything you'll give me. So Jacob understands that God's the one who's going to be giving him this stuff. So you're going to give me 10%? Wow, that's so generous of you. Wow, Jacob, you're such a man. You're such a faithful guy. I don't think Jacob gets it. On one hand, I'll be willing to give him a little bit more of a pass, because I think in the ancient way of thinking, vows are much more common than they are now. All right, it's just something that was kind of a standard way of worshiping God. You make a vow with him. All right, but so I'll give Jacob a little bit of a pass that way, but I don't think Jacob gets it. And what he doesn't, it's not just that Jacob doesn't believe. Because, I mean, kind of how can you not sort of believe a little bit after you had this vision, right? I don't think Jacob understands grace. I don't think he gets grace. It's very hard for a manipulative, conniving person to get grace. Because they're almost like, they're diametrically opposed to each other. Okay, so if you're always trying to grasp and take whatever you can, you can't believe in grace because grace says, is generosity. I'm just going to give this to you. So Jacob does not understand grace. And you see it playing out in his life, the way he approaches people, the way that he approaches situations. You know, Jacob's going to go through some difficult times in his life. And some of them he pretty much brought upon himself by the way he acted. But he's going to be manipulated. He's going to be lied to. He's going to be stolen from. And how is he going to respond in those instances? And the hardest thing that Jacob ever has to go through in his life, well, just two quick instances. One, he has to go back and face Esau. Talk about awkward, right? All right, so after many years, they're eventually reunited. And Jacob, he's just thinking, okay, how can we survive this? Now, remember, he's been promised by God, I'm going to be with you. I'm going to take you back safely to this land. So when Jacob eventually has, you know, a couple wives, got, like, lots of children, 12 sons, daughters, lots of herds and flocks. When he's on his way back, he splits them up into two groups because then he's thinking, well, if Esau chases after me, you know, one group can get away. You know, he can't get both groups at once, right? So he's in survival mode. He's trying to plan his way out of this. And then when he eventually meets Esau, you know, he kind of growls a little bit, and he has this whole bunch of, like, you know, animals and this big herd that he's going to give Esau as a gift. And Esau's just happy to see Jacob. Miracle of miracles. Esau doesn't kill him. Even though Esau rides out like with a bunch of trained men, and Jacob's like, oh boy, this is not going to go well. Esau just basically hugs him. Like, I'm glad to have you back. And Jacob tries to give him this huge herd, and Esau's like, don't you see how much God's blessed me? I don't need that. No, you don't need to give me that. But see, in Jacob's mind, I need to do this. I can't just accept forgiveness. I can't just accept grace. I need to sort of pay you back. Now, it's not wrong to make recompense for something. I'm not saying that. But you can just see in Jacob's mind, he doesn't quite understand grace or know what to do when somebody shows him grace. And he's still not really believing that promise that God gave him. Not 100% anyway. Then later on in Jacob's life, he goes through the hardest time. He loses his son. Now, you know, these people never learn from their mistakes, you know, because of how Jacob and Esau, the whole thing was about favoritism. Well, Jacob had his favorite sons too. One of them was Joseph. And he put Joseph in sort of a supervisor role over his older brothers. The older brothers didn't like Joseph, decided they were going to kill him, but then they had a change of heart and said, nah, we won't kill him, we'll just sell him to slavery. Killing him's too harsh, we'll just sell him off and make some money off of it, so that'll be a good deal for us. But they come back and they tell Jacob that Joseph was dead. And so for many years, Jacob believes that Joseph, you know, his favorite son, he had another favorite son, Benjamin, but the, you know, Joseph is dead. And I think he's a very bitter man. Now, you could understand why he'd be bitter in that case or why he'd be upset, right? You could see why he'd be hurt. But still, I don't think he's getting grace because when you trust God and you believe in his grace, you know, you believe that things will work out. Even though you go through times of tragedy and sadness, I don't know that Jacob ever gets to that place of faith in those times. You just see whenever he talks in Genesis, which isn't a lot because the story kind of shifts over to Joseph, he just seems very bitter, very upset. You know, he's got no joy in life. And in the end, what happens? He's reunited with Joseph. All right? And then I think maybe then he gets it, or maybe he's just responding to the situation. But he has such a hard time with grace. Just can't understand it. He can't accept that God's completely there for him. He's going to see him through all the way. Because maybe in Jacob's mind, he thinks, well, I know what I've done. Maybe he knows he's not that great of a guy. You know, maybe he's acknowledging that to some extent, but he just doesn't get grace. See, it's a problem for us when we don't get grace. Because we have no place with God except for grace. That's why religion fails on so many counts, because it says to some extent that you can earn this, that you can earn your place with God, that you can put yourself in a place where he's going to bless you. And maybe you don't think of God quite as obligated to do that, but he kind of is. And so maybe we don't make these vows to God where we make these sort of ludicrous promises like we're going to give him whatever, like, you know, think it's a big deal. But it pops up in other ways. It pops up in the ways that we look at people and the ways that we look at God. When we don't believe grace, what happens is we underestimate God If you notice, like, the promises that God gives Jacob are these huge, like, big picture promises. And what does Jacob go after? Give me food to eat, put clothes on my back. God's like, I just promised to give you all these descendants, to give you all this land, and you're asking me for a little bit of food. See the disparity there? He underestimates God. And when you underestimate God, you're never sure how things are going to work out. You know, in the portion that I read to you before the service started from Romans 8, I didn't read one verse. I didn't read Romans 8, 28 and a few verses after that. But Romans 8, 28 says, everything works out together for the good of those who love God, who've been called according to his purpose. If you don't understand grace, though, you don't believe that. And so when tragedy strikes, when unfortunate things happen, you either turn away from God or you start ignoring God or you're done with him. You know, he didn't do what you needed him to do. He didn't do what you wanted him to do. And if you don't believe in his grace, you're not going to keep walking with God after that. Tragedy is going to put you completely off the rails. All right, it also affects the way we approach other people. We're always suspicious of them. We're always afraid they're going to try to take something away from us. So our way of working with other people becomes to manipulate them, to try to get what we want, not to forgive, to hold grudges. When we don't understand grace, it just throws apart everything in our lives. It's the only place that we have with God. We have no other way to stand before him. None. Because the grace that we've received is a little bit different than the grace that Jacob received. In the sense that God just didn't give us promises about lands and being a nation, descendants and all that kind of stuff. He gave us his son. That's his grace to us. And it says, in Romans 5 that we were still enemies. He gave us his son. So this was not, well, you guys are doing such a great job that I thought I'd finish the deal for you and help you out a little bit. No, this was like, you were rebelling against me. You were enemies against me. You were basically spitting in my face, insulting me, walking away from me, and I sent my son to you. You had nothing to commend yourself to me, nothing to say that you belonged with me, and I sent my son to you anyway and took away your sin, took away your shame, forgave your sins, gave you eternal life, gave you my spirit. These are some pretty serious blessings that we've been given through Christ. In fact, it says in Ephesians 1 that through Christ, God has given us every spiritual blessing. That's grace. It's pure, unadulterated grace. And that's how we stand before God today. And if we don't get that grace, we're always going to approach God. One of the biggest things that changes is our motivation for doing things. Because when we don't quite believe in God's grace, we still feel like we got to earn it. And so the things that we do for him, showing up here on Sunday, praying, taking communion, reading your Bible, sharing your faith, anything else you do sort of in the name of God is not really quite in his name. It's a little bit for you because you need this to enhance your standing with him. That's what happens if you don't believe grace. All right, and you always stand in sort of a wait-and-see kind of mode with God. Just like Jacob. Jacob was in a wait-and-see. You do these things for me, God, then I'll reciprocate. But see, if you don't trust in grace, you can never really have true faith because you're always going to be waiting to see the result before you go. But that's not the kind of faith that God asks for. He tells Abraham, go to the land I'm going to show you. He doesn't tell him where it is. He doesn't give him a destination. No GPS coordinates, no nothing. Just go, and I'll show you eventually when you get there. Abraham's got to believe. He's got to believe before he sees the results. In fact, in Hebrews 11, it's this long list of people who live by faith. And in the end, the writer says, none of them, in a sense, saw what they really hoped for. Because what they were hoping for was something bigger. It was something better than earthly blessings. They were putting their faith not in an earthly city, but in a heavenly city. So their faith called them to something higher, to something deeper. And you never get to that kind of faith if you don't get grace, because you always want to wait to see how this is going to pan out. And so it's very possible there are some of us here who are in a wait-and-see kind of approach with God, because we need to see how things are going to turn out before we're really going to turn to him. And the whole way that we stand before God is by grace through faith. And if you don't believe in grace, you don't really get faith either. You need to understand grace, that God could just bless you Because he's good. Because he's gracious. And when you can accept that, then everything else starts falling in line with your life. The way you approach God, your motivations become pure. You're not about trying to earn. You're just you're not even paying back. You're just loving because you've been loved. It's a very different approach. And you become much more generous, much more gracious with other people. You know, the people who don't forgive, people who sit there and judge everybody else and tear other people apart and say, well, look at that person. You know, they do all these things wrong. People who do that, they don't get grace. They just don't. And so the question is today, do you get grace? Do you understand what God has done in your behalf for you? Apart from anything that you've done, do you get that? Can you accept it? Grace is an awesome thing, and yet it's one of the hardest things for people to accept. I mean, when people offer you something free, right? I mean, free is great. When somebody just gives you somebody, you get something free. Isn't that awesome? I never turn down free food or, you know, anything like that. You know, you get something free. It's awesome. And yet, if you're walking down the street and somebody, like, you know, says, hey, here's something free, you don't trust them. Even if somebody you know offered you something free, you're still a little bit, you know, hesitant to accept that, right? It's hard for people to accept grace. And that's why it's hard for people to walk with Jesus Christ. Because the only way to walk with him is grace. His grace, your faith, you trusting in that grace. And so hopefully today, as we look at this table, at these elements which really declare his grace to us, we can come to a place where we accept his grace and where his grace is what begins to move us and shape us and make us who we are. So I'm going to pray as I pray. I'm going to invite the gentleman to come forward and help me serve. But let's think about God's grace.